I thought about starting this talk by giving a great big Zen shout. In trying to put some thoughts together and thinking about what I wanted to say and how to say it, I felt like screaming. So now I understand why. How that works. What I would like to offer this afternoon is to say a few words about Genjo Koan, the meaning of the phrase Genjo Koan. Talk a little bit about Dogen's understanding of sitting practice or understanding of meditation practice and how that might be similar or different to our insight practice, and then look at one section of Genjo Koan that is probably safe to say is the most well-known famous section, which is considered to be a condensation of all of Genjo Koan in just a few lines. And that's the section on to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So I think often in a kind of popular imagination, understanding of Zen practice, often people think about koans as being synonymous with Zen practice. And you know, for those of you who aren't familiar with this word, a koan is a kind of, it's a case or a story, but it usually presents some kind of question or riddle or paradox, some kind of expression of duality or opposites that the student is meant to resolve. But it's not a resolution by thinking about it. One of the famous ones is what is the sound of one hand clapping, right? You know, and so it's like maybe one way of understanding that is the question of, what does oneness sound like? What does oneness sound like? And so it's something to kind of sit with and meditate with. And then the idea is not that you bring the teacher an answer, but that you practice with it and have a certain kind of experience and then bring yourself to the teacher and show yourself. In the classical system of koan practice, often the student sees the teacher 3, 4, 5 times a day, you know, and brings their understanding to the teacher. When I was in Japan, and I just did this for a very little bit, the koan I received was, before mother and father, show me your original face. You know, before your mother and father were born, show me your original face. And, you know, and I remember going in to see the Roshi, and he has a bell, and the bell means you're done. He rings the bell. And, you know, walking in and sitting down and looking at him and about to open my heart, ding, 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 ding. Get out. So there's a certain kind of, we could say, humility that develops. And so this is one style of koan practice, one way of working with koans. About a week ago, I was co-teaching a course. I don't think anyone here was there, from at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And I was teaching it with a Zen teacher. And the title of the course was, the subject of the course was the psychology and insight of Zen koans. And so he uses koans not so much as concentration devices, but as sort of almost the way a psychoanalyst might look at a dream. You know, that it's a story, and the different aspects of the story represented different parts of us. And so it was very nice, and you know, it was. We talked about these different koans, different stories, and but in the evening, we did a practice that comes from another koan, which is kind of famous, which is, it goes something like, the teaching of the Buddha is that all beings, without exception, have Buddha nature. Does a dog have Buddha nature? And so the student asks this, the teacher says, no. You know, and so, and that's the koan. All beings have Buddha nature. So you think, well, a dog must have Buddha nature. And then the teacher says, no. And in the Chinese kind of tradition, that no is expressed as mu. So this is kind of the koan of mu. And when a student is given mu, it's like you, your whole practice becomes mu. Everything becomes mu. Every breath. Breathe out. You know, and it's like this, it becomes this kind of mantra. And so we're instructed to sit with it, to sit with mu, to walk with mu, to eat with mu, to sleep with mu. Everything becomes mu. And then you bring in to the teacher your mu, and show the teacher your, not a cow's mu, this is the mu of, and so it's said to be, it's not the mu, it's not no, as in no is the opposite of yes, but it's the no that cuts through everything, that includes everything, that completely empties our mind. You know, that's a mu. And so on this retreat last week, we, in the last sitting, the end of the night, we did a mu practice out loud. And it just started that you, on each out breath, you just go, mu. And so at first the teacher started it, and then everybody kind of slowly, in kind of a quiet way, just and different voices, different pitches. And then little by little, the moo got louder, got stronger, got more and more powerful, more and more intense. And I had done this years ago, but I'd forgotten the kind of intensity of it. And I looked over at my co-teacher, and just the expression on it, she was, you know, and it was really like a bonfire. Mu became a bonfire to throw everything in, all of your feelings, all your memories, all of your hopes, your expectations, your frustrations, everything, all of the suffering of the world, all of the joy of the world became mu. And it got louder and louder and louder and more intense. And at one point it was like a moan. It was a moan. People were really getting into it. And then when it reached this kind of fever pitch, my co-teacher went, and then it completely stopped. You know, and it was like, the silence was just so, there was this energy in the silence, it was palpable, it was thick, the silence was thick. And I thought, oh yeah, yeah, that's Mu. It's like we became one being. And I had this, it may just be my own story, but I had this feeling that it was like the deepest emotions that we're carrying, the deepest pain, the deepest wounds, were able to just be so fully expressed and so fully thrown into this bonfire. That was the kind of feeling of it. So something was being manifested. Something was being actualized. So this is one flavor of koan practice. And it's interesting to reflect that the Genjo koan, one translation of Genjo koan is manifesting reality, actualizing reality, actualizing what's true. So it has this active quality to it. So koan is like this question, this challenge to us. And Genjo, is actualizing, manifesting. Sometimes this is translated as the koan of this moment, the question of this moment. So Genjo koan has the flavor of bringing to life, fully engaging in what is immediately in front of us. You know, this moment, right here, this. The Genjo koan is meeting life itself, the question of this moment. So you know, you kind of get a flavor for this. And it's interesting to reflect that for Dogen, as Brian was saying, Dogen wrote this in Japanese, not in the kind of classical Sino-Japanese or Chinese that a lot of the other writings, his other writings were in. And Dogen was like this basically spiritual genius. I mean, in the volume of his, you know, I think it's like 2,000 pages or something of his collected works, which is called the Shobogenzo. And the very first chapter, the very first, right at the beginning of Shobogenzo is this text, the Genjo Koan. So some people feel that this is like the exquisite summation of Dogen's understanding about practice. Sometimes Genjo Koan is translated as the way of everyday life, the question of this moment. I think the translation we have here is called actualizing the fundamental point. But it has this quality of immediacy and taking care of what is right in front of us. You know, this is Genjo Koan. Yesterday in the evening, I talked about this other koan, or this other question about a coin that is lost in the river is found in the river. And this idea about what we're looking for, what we're seeking, what we've lost is found right here in our life, right here in the substance of this moment, of this life as it is. And This for me is very closely connected to Genjo Koan. It's when we're not looking somewhere else, we're not going out there to, you know, of course we do. We go to teachers, we look in books, we do all these things. But at the bottom of things, the answer, what we're looking for, is found here in our experience, in the flow of this river, this flow of experience as it is. And I think this is a very powerful, you know, if we don't take anything else from, you know, this approach to practice, it's that this returning, turning back, and this willingness to be here, this willingness to be with ourselves as we are, and it takes a lot of, can take a lot of courage, a lot of trust, to stay here and be with ourselves and believe that the answers are found here. And this is very much the nature of insight. You know, it's like one of my favorite images about insight is this, are those drawings that you can see, you know, you can see the, what is it, the duck and the rabbit. You know, first you might see it as a duck. You look at it, and then someone says, you know, it's a rabbit. And he's like, what are you talking? You know, it's so obviously a duck. But if you look at it and you kind of stay with it and you go look away and you look at it, and then it's so much like, oh, wow. Our perception shifts. And you say, okay, it's also a rabbit. And then you can see it as a duck. And then you can see it as a rabbit. And, you know, so maybe this a little practice is like this a little bit, that, you know, there's a way that we can see our life that has, and this world that has a lot of problems and a lot of heartbreak and a lot of suffering. And at the same time, there's a kind of perfection there. There's a completeness there. That it just is what it is. And that purity, that perfection, does not negate the suffering. You know, it's like they're both there. You can see it this way, and you can see it this way. So this is sort of approaching Dogen's understanding of meditation practice. The word that Dogen most often uses for sitting practice, for meditation practice, is called, in Japanese, is shikantaza. And shikantaza is usually translated as just sitting. Just sitting. So, just means only sitting, completely, only or completely, like really doing this one thing. For its own sake, you know. And then sitting, of course, means sitting, but it means everything, basically. It means walking, it means all the different activities that we do. So what does it mean to say meditation practice as just sitting? Dogen also says that shikantaza, just sitting, is not a technique. It's not like if we just sit in this way, then, you know, at some point we'll get enlightened. At some point our suffering will go away. At some point. It's like, I think so much of our life is oriented around doing something for a purpose, right? You know, it's normal, it's natural, it's a very human thing. And then even in terms of meditation and Buddhism, we can, there's so much in the media and the literature about, oh, meditation is great for this and it's great for that, and you're just going to increase your hippocampus or something, you know, and you know, make you happier, and for depression and this and that, and great, all these wonderful things. But for Dogen, and for this understanding of just sitting, it means to totally do this practice for no other purpose than to just do it, than to just, so it's to just sit, to just be. Is he kind of getting a little bit of the flavor of that? I always chuckle about this. A couple of years ago, we had the 50th anniversary of the Berkeley Zen Center, and they made T-shirts, and the T-shirt said something like, "Berkeley Zen Center, accomplishing nothing for 50 years." There's a little bit of the flavor of just sitting. We're not getting anywhere. There's nowhere to get to, right? You know. So to meet this moment on its own terms, in some ways it's the simplest practice, but it's quite challenging to do, you know, because it, in the sense of that, first of all, we all come to practice because we feel like we've lost something, we're missing something, you know, this is dukkha, this is the coin that we've lost in the river. And so to just acknowledge that, and part of the challenge and the beauty of this just sitting practice is to sit with the intention of to be with this mind, be with this heart, be with this body, just as it is. And then to see how unwilling most of us are to do that most of the time. We'll do almost anything to avoid being with ourselves. And so to come to a place like this is an amazing thing. It's this amazing shift to be willing to be with ourselves and meet ourselves. And it also is going to stir us up in a lot of ways, you know. And so one of the ways that I appreciate Zen practice and understanding this practice of just sitting is that it's a practice of learning to be with all the things that we came to practice to avoid. You're learning to be with all the things that we came to practice to avoid. I know for myself, one of the reasons that I started practicing was that I realized that I was a person who had a lot of fear. You know, there's a way that little by little I saw that fear and anxiety and worrying about the future, trying to control things, get them to be the way I know they should be. And this was causing me a lot of suffering. And I thought that if I learn how to meditate, I'll become a person who doesn't have fear. You know, I'll become a person who doesn't need to control so much and can kind of loosen up and enjoy life more. And one of the things I learned as I started to practice was that the most important thing for me, the deepest request that was there, was to actually sit with this fear and meet this fear and get to know this fear and learn how to, it wasn't going to be about deleting the fear, or it can make the mind like a laser and just, you know, shows up just. It was much more about finding finding a way to be at peace with it, finding a way to be to welcome it, to include it. And when I learn to do that, I learn to meet it and study it, then something started to shift in that relationship. I have a friend who is an old friend from college, and she attended the retreat that I taught on the East Coast last week. And it was her first meditation retreat, but she's done a lot of meditation practice on her own. And we talk about meditation sometimes. And because we've known each other for more than 20 years, we were kind of just asking each other, like, how do I seem different from you than when we were in school? How do you seem different? And one of the things I said to her was that there was a way that I felt when we were friends back in college, when we were working together, that she was this great person and really a person with a lot of passion and depth. But I felt that whenever I brought something to her that was a kind of difficult emotion or negative emotion, or I said something like, oh, I'm just really feeling sad about something, or I felt like it made her very uncomfortable. I mean, you can relate to this. I can certainly relate to this. But I felt like it made her very uncomfortable. And there was a way that she could not hear it, didn't want to hear it, didn't want to, you know, say, oh, well, that's okay. Well, you'll feel better later. I got to go. Bye. Something like that. Maybe not so extreme, but... And it was a little jarring to me because this was a person who had this really wide range in a lot of other ways. But with something that was difficult, it felt like she couldn't be with it and she couldn't hear it. And I just said to her, in the last few years, I felt that totally changed with her. That there was this way that she has become this wonderful listener. And that she could receive and hold and stay there and meet and connect in a way that I'm sure I don't think I could have done that 20 years ago. And I don't think she could have done that. And I said to her, does that resonate for you? What do you think about that? And how do you understand that? And she said, yeah. And she said, I grew up in a family that was... She said, my parents fought a lot, and my mother cried all the time. And so I'd have to, you know, I was just going to be there and hear my parents fighting and my mother being really upset. And at some point as a teenager, I started to cry. And then I got kind of disgusted with myself. And I said, I'm not going to be like this. I'm never going to do this again. And she said, I didn't express emotion, this kind of painful emotion, feel painful emotion, for years and years. You know, she kind of cut that part out. And what changed for her, she said, were two things. One was starting to meditate. And the second one was becoming a mother, becoming a parent. I feel emotional. That there is a, I think there's a, you know, in both of these practices, the practice of meditating and the practice of parenting, sooner or later, it involves this willingness to be vulnerable. This willingness to open ourselves, to include all of who we are, all of who someone else is, and be with that, and sort of find our composure with that, And one way of understanding this practice is it's a journey in being more and more open, more and more sensitive, more and more vulnerable. You know, this is the truth of impermanence and interdependence, which is what the Buddha taught. You know, that we are all this kind of interbeing. We're all connected to each other. And so whether we're doing a kind of mu practice where we're kind of throwing everything into the bonfire, or we're doing this kind of shikantaza practice, just sitting, just being the moment, just being willing to be not only bliss and joy and just the breath, and it's so, yes, the breath is so calming, and you know, yeah, okay, that's fine. But what about anger? What about fear? What about frustration? Are we willing to be that? Are we willing to meet that? Are we willing to meet those, the times when the last thing we want to do is be here and stay here. And sometimes it's just a victory to stay in the room, you know? That something can be so painful, can feel like such a struggle. And this is really good practice. You know, we don't want to overwhelm our system and force ourselves to kind of be with something that's too much to handle. But to be willing to kind of go up to our edge, to go up to what you know, the edge of our comfort or our discomfort. And so one image of this is that practice is like building a bigger container. When our container is very small, you know, it's like, you know, I had this a little bit last week and I had flown back from the East Coast and I was jet lagged and then a bunch of other stuff happened. And I just noticed that I just had this kind of feeling of like a little bit of a brittleness. You know, it's like, and I got an email, and my first, you know, it's like, and they kind of wanted something from me. My first, oh. You know, it was not an unreasonable email, but my container, just in that moment, was so tiny that any sort of pushing on it or request, it felt like, oh, I can't do this right now, you know. So, you know, we know those moments, we have those moments. Due to causes and conditions, sometimes we'll feel that way. And then, little by little, in practice, you know, this idea of building a bigger container that's getting wider and wider and wider, that we're able to include more and more of the full range of our humanity, more and more of the full range of who we are, and to be able to not flinch from that, to be able to hold it, to sit with it. You know, so this is just sitting too, to be able to just be the moment, regardless of the content of the moment. You know, sometimes it will feel like this, and sometimes it will feel like that. Sometimes we'll feel good, and sometimes we'll feel pretty lousy. You know, that's life. And if we think practice is going to take us to a place where we feel good all the time, you know, good luck. Let me know how, teach me how to do that. If you figure it out. We can have those ideas. But it's not about becoming a stone Buddha. You know, it's not about being the statue that is indifferent. You know, I don't think that kind of practice would appeal to me. I don't want to be indifferent to my suffering. I don't want to be indifferent to the suffering of the world. I want to be able to meet suffering and not be not be destroyed by it, you know, to be able to somehow keep our composure. And so shikantaza practice, just sitting practice, has this flavor of to be able to meet the moment however it happens to be. One way we avoid the moment, you know, I'm very familiar with this, is escaping into a kind of fantasy world, right? You know, we are sitting, I spent many retreats, you know, dreaming, fantasizing, you know, or remembering. I know one long time, longer retreat I spent in a Zen monastery, and I felt like I went through my whole life, you know, just went back and back and back. It was sort of like reliving my life. You know, I wasn't at meditating that much. I was just, you know. So we do this. The mind does this. And so we can avoid the moment by escaping into a kind of mental world. We can also avoid the moment by escaping into concentration, escaping into samadhi. Oh, but that's good, right? That's what the Buddha taught, is get concentrated. And yeah, the concentration is good. It's a great thing. But it could also be a way of avoiding feelings, avoiding emotions. And, you know, so just to kind of check it out, what is it to be here, to be willing to enter this moment and experience it as it is? So this is kind of the flavor of just sitting, of shikantaza. I'm not going to read the whole poem, but this, when I was trying to think of how to put into words my feeling about what just sitting practice feels like, this line from Mary Oliver came up. If I put it here. I think it's from the poem that's called When Death Comes. But she says, "When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms." What is it to be married to amazement? That the ordinary moment, the ordinary things, the things that we take for granted, take on this miraculous quality. This is also can be the flavor of shikantaza, of just sitting. When we're fully here, we're not trying to get anything. We're not trying to get away from anything. We're just here, just willing to be here. This gorgeous world of shikantaza can open, that we see the most ordinary thing has this unlimited quality, this depth to it. The other example I thought about, just in trying to kind of come up with some illustration, was that if I asked you to go outside here in IRC, in the parking lot, and I said, I want you to walk around the building three times, and if after you walk around the building three times, we're going to give you $100. You know, I don't know, something to get, right? Okay, I can do that. Go out, you walk around, and you may notice, you have to be mindful enough not to get lost, right? You know, but chances are, I know I'd be thinking about, wow, $100, that's pretty cool, just for walking around the building, okay. Maybe if I go faster, I'll get even more, you know, I don't know what, you know. We might not be noticing that much. We might not be looking at the trees, at the sky. We might not be smelling the air. We might not be feeling the softness of the wood chips under our feet, you know, because we've got something to do, right? We've got a kind of mission. And sometimes meditation practice can feel like that. If we're very oriented in a model of progress, you know, and I'm here and I'm a kind of deluded person, and one day after I do a lot of practice, as Brian was saying this morning, then I'll get there, wherever there is, somewhere there. That gives a certain kind of flavor to our experience. Okay, and then what if we said, I have some bad news. The world is going to end in about 7 minutes. And the only thing that you can really do right now is just go outside and walk around. That's all we can really do. I know for me, that would have a very different flavor of like wanting to be so there, wanting to be so present, maybe doing the same thing, walking around, but to be so connected, so alive to experience that it's like there is no future, right? You know, 7 minutes, there's nothing to get. There's no point in even, you know, worrying, right? What can we do? Just to fully be there. Something can fall away. And, you know, so that gives it a little different flavor. It's the same garden, it's the same trees, it's the same wood chips. But when the future is cut off and the past is cut off, we're just there. Everything is just being itself, manifesting itself, manifesting Genjo Koan, moment after moment after moment. And it's that this moment is not some means, some stepping stone to the next moment. This moment is just itself, is just here for itself, just expressing itself. And there's can be a kind of feeling of completion, of perfection in that. So that's the kind of the flavor of just sitting. One teacher described it as, we just are, we just sit. And in the very act of sitting, we actualize the completeness of the act itself. And we actualize our own full completeness as a human being, another name for which is Buddha. So this idea of, to understand Buddha means to understand ourselves, to fully understand ourselves, to fully be ourselves. Buddha isn't something up there or out there or in the history books. So Dogen has this idea of enlightenment is not the end of our practice. You know, the kind of one way of thinking is we practice, and then we get to the goal, which is enlightenment. But Dogen says our practice begins from enlightenment. Enlightenment is what takes us, brings us here. We're all here. An awakened intention, an awakened thought, an awakened being is what brought us here. And practice is not about trying to get what we don't have, but it's about trying to express and fully manifest what we are, what we do have. So the only reason we can practice is because of our enlightenment, because of our original enlightenment, original awakening. So this is, you know, you can kind of say there's a little bit of a different flavor. And one of the ways I enjoy thinking about it is that when we take on this flavor of Zen practice, we can understand it as post-enlightenment practice. You know, what if we all are already fully and completely awakened? we've done it. Whatever we think we need to do, whatever we think we're missing, we've got it. We've done it. Mission accomplished. And then the question is, now what? What does a Buddha do? How does a Buddha sit? How does a Buddha live? And this is the practice of just sitting, just being the moment. A Buddha, you know, is able to just be with whatever arises, whatever's there. And so, you know, when we think about it as post-enlightenment practice, I know for myself, as I can relax. I don't have to live my life or practice this retreat as if I'm somehow, you know, whatever it is, it's just out of reach, you know, I almost have it. Not quite there. And so this flavor of practice gives this wonderful sense of being rooted in our own experience, our own being. Somewhere in the text, Dogen says, when you find your place right where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. This is Genjo Koan. When you find your place right where you are, when we can have this understanding that our experience moment to moment is foundational. It's not about getting to something else. It's not missing something. It's not that someone else's experience is so different, so much better than mine. When we have that experience of this is enough, this is Genjo Koan. Practice occurs. We're actualizing reality, because that is the nature of reality. Someone once asked one of my Zen teachers, what's the difference between the student's mind and the teacher's mind? Good question. And he said, the difference is that the student thinks there's a difference. You know? So I think this is what Dogen is getting at with this to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So right there, you know, usually we think, what could be farther apart from me and a Buddha? And Dogen is taking these things that we think are so far apart, so opposite, and boom. To study the Buddha way, to study Buddha, to understand Buddha, is to understand ourself. Is to meet ourself as we are, to be with ourselves, to get connected, to get close, to get intimate with what's right here, what's right in front of us, which is ourself. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self. You know, there's many translations of Genjo Koan, and sometimes some people say that study is a good word, but maybe, you know, to understand the Buddha is to understand ourselves. I like this one. To practice the Buddha way is to practice ourself, to be ourself. What is it to practice oneself? And to practice has this flavor of doing something over and over and over again. So it's like on retreat practice, over and over and over again, we come back. We come back to this experience of the body. We come back to this ordinary experience of the body, the breath, opening to sounds, opening to emotions. Again and again, meeting ourselves. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self. And then to study the self is to forget the self. So there's something about, in order to fully be ourselves, to fully be who we are, we need to go beyond ourselves. You know, we need to, in some way, get so connected and so absorbed in the flow of this river of experience that we lose ourselves, that we can't, that the boundaries of where I end and the world begins, where you begin, start to not make that much sense. You know, in this flow of the river of experience. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Then he says, to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. So when we can in some way go beyond this small self and enter into the flow of life, surrender to life as it is, the flow of our experience as it is, then everything comes forth to help us. Everything is right there. And we are actualized. We are who and what we are is manifested by all things, by the myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. And so this is a little bit of a circle, a little bit of a loop. We come to practice because maybe we think that this mind, this body, this heart is somehow incomplete, somehow missing something, somehow deficient in some way. And what Dogen maybe is saying is that by meeting ourselves and being willing to fully be with ourselves as we are, moment to moment, as life is, moment to moment, there's a kind of we touch in to this world of just this world of this is enough, this is perfect and complete in and of itself. And then everything is us, everything is helping us, everything is coming forth to meet us. When you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from it. You know? Yeah, we think we're far away. We've lost something, we're missing something, there's some problem. But Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. So I think in some way it is the most difficult and in some ways most painful, most challenging, but also the most beautiful practice, you know, to be willing to be with ourselves, accompany ourselves, behold ourselves. That we don't need to compare ourselves to anybody else, to anything else. We're, you know, that to have this trust that moment to moment to moment, reality, the Dharma, is presenting itself to us, and to just be here, to meet it, even, you know, when it's difficult. See if we can stay, see if we can find the beauty, even in what's difficult, what may feel ordinary, what may feel... this is a tremendous gift that we give to ourselves. And to learning how to offer this to ourselves, it's something that we can bring to the world. To meet the world on its own terms, to meet others as they are, not as who we think they should be, want them to be. So maybe let's just sit for a minute. If Genjo Koan is the koan, the question of this moment, what is your question right now? What is this moment asking of you? Is there something that can be open to right now? Is there something that can be met with love, with care, with kindness? Is there something that you don't need anymore that can be let go of? This is Genjo Koan, the question of right now, right here. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away, fall away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. Thank you very much.